Well, the Battle of Lepanto, as we've been looking at the victories over Islam, many people have the impression that Islam can't be beaten or that Christians have no chance fighting against this radical, intolerant religion. But this is one of the most important battles in history. The Battle of Lepanto occurred on the 7th of October, 1571. And it's one of the most important, one of the most critical naval battles in all of history. The Christian League forces were led by John of Austria, and he was the half-brother of King Philip II. In other words, he is a son of Charles V, before whom Martin Luther had made his stand, "My conscience is captured, the word of God." Well, Don John of Austria was just 26 years old when he was put in charge of this fleet. The island of Cyprus had fallen to the Turkish invaders, and the Turks had treacherously violated their agreement with the Greek and the Italian defenders, and after all supplies were exhausted and ammunition was out and guarantees of safe conduct were offered, the Venetian garrison of Famagusta surrendered to the Turks. And the Turks then treacherously had all the Venetian prisoners executed, which was against the terms of surrender. And the rest were enslaved, and the courageous Christian general Marco Antonio Bragadino, he had his nose and his ears cut off, his teeth broken, he's flayed with whips until dead in the city square. Just showing the cruelty and the vindictiveness and the treachery of the Turks. Now, as the Turks were planning further invasion of Europe, a coalition of Christian forces were mustered under John of Austria. And this included 206 galleys and 6 galleasses. The Christian fleet consisted of 109 galleys and 6 galleasses from the Republic of Venice. So Venice was one of the most important naval powers at that stage, even though it's just a city-state. There were 80 galleys from Spain, 12 from the Tuscans in the Order of St. Stephen, 3 galleys each were donated from the Republic of Genoa, the Knights of Malta, the Duke of Savoy, as well as some privately owned galleys. Their fleet was manned by almost 13,000 sailors, 43,000 rowers, 28,000 soldiers, including 10,000 Spanish, 7,000 German, 6,000 Italian, 5,000 Venetian soldiers. Most of the 43,000 rowers were free oarsmen. They weren't slaves, they weren't convicts, they were paid to row and chose to row. So this is an extraordinary combination. They don't have a common language, they're from many different nations, and yet they're trying to put a cohesive naval force together from a divergent background. Now, the Christian League was outnumbered by the much larger Turkish fleet of 230 galleys and 60 galleots. Under the command of Ali Pasha, the 13,000 experienced sailors were drawn from all the maritime nations under the Ottoman Empire. Many were Egyptians, Syrians, Greeks, and Berbers. The Turkish fleet also included 34,000 soldiers. Now, while most of the sailors were not Muslim, they were employed or forced by them. The soldiers were all Muslims, Turks in particular. Now, the Christians were outnumbered in every other way, but the Christian League had two significant advantages. The first was the Christian infantry was definitely superior to the Muslim. And the Christians also had 1,815 cannon compared to just 750 cannon amongst the Turkish vessels. So the Christians were depending far more on artillery power. And the Christians also had far more advanced muskets, while the Ottomans trusted in a greatly feared composite bowman. This is also interesting because there's so much nonsense about how Europe was languishing in the Dark Ages and backward, and the Muslim nations were so much more advanced. But actually, the Christians had more advanced technology throughout this whole time, as we saw with the Greek fire that the Ottoman Empire was confronted with by the Byzantines. They had this form of almost having a flamethrower of the so-called Greek fire, and tremendous advancements in all kinds of weapons technology and shipbuilding. Now, unlike the Christian fleets, the Turkish fleet was powered entirely by Christian slaves and prisoners of war who were forced to row in chains. So this fleet of the Turks was powered by slaves. The five-hour Battle of Lepanto was fought at the edge of the Gulf of Patras, just off western Greece, near Corinth, the same Corinth where Paul wrote the letter to the Corinthians. The Ottoman forces were sailing westwards from their naval base in Lepanto when they were confronted by the Christian League fleet, which had sailed from Messina in Sicily. So they are converging right here off the coast of Greece, just at the southernmost point of the Adriatic. And the battle started when the Turks mistook the large galleasses, which were out front, to be merchant supply vessels, and they set out to pirate them. Which was
what's a galleass?
A galleass was a huge new innovation of the Venetians for transporting massive amounts of artillery. This is a galleass. The galleasses, this was the first time they were ever employed in battles. It looked like a merchant supply vessel from a distance, but in fact, it was just one big fighting platform to convey massive amounts of artillery. So as the Turks came in to loot these vessels, to pirate these galleasses, they suddenly discovered that these were carrying tremendous batteries of artillery, and the six Venetian galleasses sank up to 70 Turkish galleys before the rest of the fleet could even engage. So they started the battle 70-0. And the galleasses succeeded in breaking up the Ottoman formations. They not only had more cannon, they had better cannon, they had longer ranges too. Commander Barigo, who led the left division closest to the coast of mainly the Venetian galleons, he was killed by a Turkish arrow. But the Venetians turned to face the threat and they held the line despite losing their commander. Then Commander Pietro Giustiniani of the Knights of St. John was severely wounded by five arrows. Of course, the Muslims were using the composite bowmen a lot. Amazingly, the two flagships found themselves. The flagship of John of Austria and Ali Pasha, they managed to engage and they found one another in the middle of the battle and they locked in, and Austrian soldiers overwhelmed the Turkish janissaries on the Sultana, which was the lead flagship of Ali Pasha. And Ali Pasha was killed and he was beheaded at a critical stage in this battle. And when his severed head was displayed on a pike from the Austrian flagship, it had a devastating effect on the Turkish morale, as they saw that their leader was already finished. Spanish and German infantry flowed onto the Turkish vessels and in ferocious hand-to-hand combat, they overwhelmed the Turks. Over 210 Turkish ships were lost. Of these, 117 galleys and 10 galliots were captured in good enough condition to be used by the Christian forces in the future, which makes it even better. The enemy is deprived and your side is strengthened. The only prize captured by the Turks was one Venetian galley. On the Christian side, 20 galleys had to be destroyed and 30 damaged so seriously they had to be scuttled because of the battle. So the Christians effectively lost 50 galleys on their side. But the Turkish losses were colossal. They lost over 200 ships, and their dead were over 30,000 killed and wounded, and 15,000 Turks captured as prisoners by the Christian League. On the Christian side, 7,500 soldiers, sailors, rowers were dead, but twice as many Christian prisoners were freed from the Turkish galleys as they had lost. So Lepanto was a crushing defeat for the Turks. They lost all but 50 of their ships. And the Battle of Lepanto, following so soon after the Turkish defeats in the Great Siege of Malta in 1565, restricted the Ottoman Empire's expansion in the Mediterranean Sea. It broke the threat of Muslim dominance at sea. Lepanto was one of the great turning points in history. It ended the fear of the Turks that had threatened to overwhelm all of Europe. It was almost an irrational fear of the Turks. People felt they couldn't be beaten. It stopped the Turkish advance, at least on sea, as the battle in Vienna stopped them on land. Lepanto was the last major naval battle between rowing vessels, where they used oars. Some Western historians have held Lepanto to be the most decisive naval battle anywhere on the globe since the Battle of Actium, 31 BC. Does anyone know which the Battle of Actium was? If you know your Antony and Cleopatra, you might recall that Antony and Cleopatra's navy was destroyed by Caesar Augustus' navy at the Battle of Actium. Very key. And So naval historians have said it's the most important naval battle since Actium in 31 BC. That's extraordinary. It certainly was a turning point in history. If you've got a book on naval victories or important battles or turning points in history, and if it doesn't mention Lepanto, I'd seriously question the competence and certainly the objectivity of the author. The Turkish Empire lost so many experienced sailors, oarsmen, soldiers, that the fighting efficiency of the Ottoman Empire was never able to recover. This marked the decline of the Ottoman Empire. It is a fact that while the Ottoman Navy rebuilt ships after this, their navy avoided all major confrontations with Christian navies forever thereafter. There was no other major confrontation. So, yes, they might have rebuilt a lot of ships, but they couldn't replace the experienced sailors, and they never had the courage to face Christian navies at sea again. The newly rebuilt Turkish navy rotted in the harbours. They didn't dare come out and fight the Christians. The historian Paul Davis wrote, "The Turkish defeat stopped Turkey's expansion into the Mediterranean. In this way, it maintained Western dominance. Confidence grew in the West that the Turks, previously unstoppable, could be beaten. So Lepanto heralded the end of Turkish naval supremacy in the Mediterranean, just like the great siege of Malta had shown we can beat them on land, now it showed we can beat them on sea." And then in Vienna, they finally turned the tide and sent them packing. As historian Otto Scott observed, "Only God could have saved so divided a Europe against so determined and savage, so rich and heavily armed a foe. After Lepanto, the Turks remained a menace, but not an unconquerable one. The church bells tolled throughout Europe as many prayers of thanksgiving were offered by millions of grateful Europeans." But the question would be, how many people today even know about this battle? Just like the Battle of Malta, so key, and the Battle of Vienna, which we will look at later, where there's the lifting of the siege of Vienna is absolutely critical, 1683. And remember, just as the siege of Malta was lifted on the 11th of September 1565, the siege of Vienna was lifted on the 11th of September also, and that in 1683. Was the 11th of September two key defeats for the Muslims, chosen deliberately as a time for them to attack the symbolic heart of America on the 2001 attacks? To the Muslims, history is very important. They see the symbolism. Why do they want to name that mosque in New York right now Cordoba? That's the name of their caliphate when they ruled a large part of Europe. In the Iberian Peninsula, Spain was called the Caliphate of Cordoba. Now they want to call their mosque, built right at the heart of Ground Zero, where their terror attack took down those towers, they want to call that Cordoba. So there's a lot of symbolism, but if Christians don't know the history, then they can have the Muslims run rings around them. So it's vital that we know these things. Any questions or comments? This is just one of the great victories. We're looking at a lot of them under the understanding the Crusades, and we're going to follow up on that. We dealt with what led up to the Crusades, of course, the actual battles of the Crusades. I'm looking forward to, and we're just finalizing a lot of those presentations. I've also got another very important presentation we're going to be dealing with in 2 weeks from now, and that is on Henry Morton Stanley, one of the most extraordinary explorers in history, and his explorations across the whole of the Congo. And anyone who wants to understand what went on in Africa before colonialism and what went on during it needs to know Henry Morton Stanley, his writings through the Dark Continent and down the heart of darkness, and all the other exposés of what was going on in the Congo River and the Muslim slave trade and the rest of it. It really needs to be known, because it's a critical piece in the puzzle that's not normally understood. But again, nobody can understand the Crusades if they don't understand jihad that came before it, and nobody can be motivated to beat Islam today if they don't know how Islam was beaten in the past. But again, notice here, people united from many different Christian backgrounds, national backgrounds. They didn't have too much in common, but they had a common enemy in the Turk, and they stopped Islam by working together. Today, our people are too divided against one another, and too many Christians are fighting one another when they should be standing firm against a common enemy. Any questions or comments?
Sometimes I'm kind of curious and worried, if I may use the word, when people say they're fighting for God, and in that process you kill your fellow brothers. And I don't know, probably I'm getting it wrong somewhere, but I live in a country where people are killed in the name of religion, both Christians and Muslims. And I was discussing with somebody, you know, and I was like, if you want me to have problems with going in religion, and you know, we could start seeing each other from different perspectives.
Mm.
So I'm just curious to understand, in Christianity, are we really supposed to, you know, fight for God and kill in His name?
No. The whole purpose of Christianity is evangelism, teaching, preaching, persuasion. We don't seek to force anyone to become a Christian. No Christian is going to go out there and fight in the name of Christianity to expand Christianity, to convert people. That is not our way. We only believe in the power of persuasion and prayer, never force. However, we are not only citizens of heaven, we also are citizens of a country on earth, and we have duties on earth to our neighbor. I must love God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength, and I must love my neighbors myself. And while we would never attack anyone, and we would never want to infringe on another person's freedoms and rights, we do have the obligation to protect the innocent and the defenseless against the aggressor. You cannot weigh the defender and the aggressor in the same scales. You can't take the rapist and the policeman and put them in the same scales. The violence of the policeman to stop the rapist is not the same as the violence of the rapist. And so it is with a murderer or someone defending. So we would never want to attack a Muslim country, and we would never want to attack a Muslim. We would not try and force a Muslim to convert. And we wouldn't kill a Christian because he chooses to abandon his religion or become another religion. But Muslims do that. Muslims attack people of other religions, and they will kill their own if they apostatize, as they call it, or change the religion. So Christianity would never teach us to go and attack someone for their religion. But the Bible does teach us that it is right to defend the defenseless against the aggressors. So if the Muslims or communists or criminals attack, it is not just right, it is our duty to defend. The sixth commandment forbids murder. And in the Westminster Catechism, it spells out the teachings of the Church Fathers on and expounding all the scriptures on what's the implication. The duties required by the sixth commandment is to do everything you can to prevent murder. And the sins forbidden would be anything that restricts someone's ability to defend themselves, or any failure to defend the innocent from murder. So the command not to commit murder is not fulfilled just by me not murdering someone. It requires me to train and prepare myself to protect the defenseless and to do what is necessary to defend the defenseless against unlawful attack. Therefore, self-defense is not part of Christianity, it's not part of evangelism, but it's part of God's law that you're expected to defend your family and your neighbor and your friends when attacked by unprovoked aggression. So it's not the same thing.
For Jesus.
Yeah, so it's not the same thing as saying you're fighting for Jesus. That's not the same thing. But it's in accordance with God's law. Murder is bad. Preventing murder is good. And if that requires force, then that's what's got to be done. Unfortunately, you know, consider this. If all the sheep make a resolution in favor of vegetarianism, that's not going to change the wolf's mind. So you can have all the people deciding to be a pacifist. Let's say we all decide to be pacifists. Will it make the Muslims pacifists? Will it make the communists pacifists? Will it make any criminal down the road a pacifist? So if all the people with a conscience abandon weapons, it'll just leave the battlefield in the hands of people without a conscience. Then things get worse. So much as we would not want to harm anyone, if someone's got to get harmed, I'd rather the attacker get harmed to prevent him from committing his crime than the innocent. It's a matter of choice. It's not a matter of us saying we are wanting to get out there and kill Muslims. But if they're determined to come out and kill Christians, then somebody's got to stop them.
Yeah, I understand. You put the point. But there's also the connection and the, I call it influence, where people are actually fighting for political power.
Mm.
But the way to achieve it is to whip up the sentiment of religion. Because that's the only way you can spark a fire. If you say my ethnicity is disadvantaged, we don't have access to power, nobody's going to listen to you. But if you say we have been oppressed because we are Christians, then people have an opportunity to say, okay, we can fight for you. Because, so you understand? So people are looking for political power. But the easiest way to get to it is to use violence through the name of religion. That's where I have problems.
I'm sure that's been done a lot over the years, and I'm sure it's even being done today. And we must be wise, and we must be discerning, and we must not fall for that. There's always people who want to use us for political ends, and we've got to recognize there's some people whose primary allegiance is to their politics. And they just use Christianity and religious terminology as a disguise. It's not their sentiment. They've got a political agenda. It's not the Great Commission. They're not serving God's honor. So those people, we must never find ourselves serving their cause. Yes.
Yeah, I also don't know if my question is going to be very appropriate, but you're quite right. You're quite on point when you say that Muslims play a lot on the significance of history. they try to repeat history, and so what you mentioned as the Qadwa is a very, very significant point for them. You know, and you have people like Ahmadinejad saying, or the fellow who is in Turkey now, who's been speaking quite aggressively in recent times, that's Erdogan, the Prime Minister of Turkey. And these are all people who have expansionist kind of ideologies. They want to increase their influence around the world. They want to promotes causes that are essentially Islamic in nature. Perhaps somewhere there in his mind, Ahmadinejad thinks that he is today's renewed passion kingdom. You know, he's the head of that renewed passion kingdom. So, what would be the right response to them now? They're quite aggressive.
Yes.
They are not people who believe in the power of dialogue. You know, they are people whose goals are essentially militaristic. Mm. What would be the response of the Christian community or the Christian Christendom to this kind of...
Well, the first thing, and that's an important question, the first thing is we've got to understand, my people are destroyed from lack of knowledge. There's a lot of ignorance of history. And it's important to us, that's why we have these history presentations. I think until people understand the threat that Islam has posed to civilization, and the threat that the Turks in particular have played within that to civilization, and the role they've played in slavery and terrorism through these, which is why we wrote the book, Slavery, Terrorism, Islam, the Historical Roots and Contemporary Threat. I think as people come to understand where Islam stands, what it has done, the track record in history, its actual teachings, not just the past but the contemporary threat, then they'd be able to understand. But most people in Europe don't even understand what Turkey's done in the past or what the Quran teaches to recognize the significance of what these men are saying. And you can't beat an idea except by a better idea. Now, Islam and Sharia law and jihad need to be beaten by something more powerful. The gospel of Jesus Christ is more powerful than their message of hate. But secular humanism is powerless to defeat Islam. The secular humanists are absolutely incapable of stopping Islamic jihad and the resurgence of fundamentalist Islamic fanaticism. I think, one of the very finest DVDs produced so at this stage to expose Islam is Islam Rising, the call for one world domination, or Ummah. And this four-point program is what I think we need to have shown to our churches and have people understand, that they can understand Islam. This is the film, this is the book that we think would help, multimedia. There's also the films on Sudan. If people can understand what's been going on in Sudan, and these are the films produced by the Jeremiah Films people that we took into Sudan to help. So again, these are weapons. So I believe the weapons we use is information, knowledge, prayer. We want to mobilize people. We want to understand the challenge of Islam. We understand what the Bible says in prophecy about Islam, the end of Islam. Islam is doomed to defeat, biblically, prophetically, ultimately. And we need to have a positive attitude towards the future by understanding exactly what the Bible says about it. And then to compare the Bible with the Quran, objectively, calmly, rationally. This is what the Quran says, this is what the Bible says. Compare Jesus with Muhammad. It's no contest when you put them in the boxing ring, who's going to win. So we put together the Muslim Evangelism Workshop based on these sort of things. So I think one of the key ways of beating Islam is to evangelize them. Muslims are pouring into our areas and seeking to win converts from people from a Christian background, nominally Christian background maybe, but still. Why? It's safe for them. Because Christians aren't even trying to evangelize the Muslims. But if all Muslims coming into Christian-dominated areas evangelize the Muslims consistently, they wouldn't exactly be coming into our areas so enthusiastically. They'd be either getting converted and becoming our brothers and sisters in Christ, or they'd be telling others don't come and they'd be moving back. So I think evangelism, attack, in a spiritual sense. They are saying hate and kill. We are saying love, teach, pray, persuade. And our Christian friends in Sudan have shown us how to win their enemies to Christ even. So ultimately, we're talking about spiritual warfare, dealing with heavenly powers. And that's why we believe the power of prayer is vital. We've got to have a revival of prayer. We've got to understand some of the people who are assisting Islam. Just this little DVD, which shows clips of how Obama's promoted Islam and what he says about Islam and the Holy Quran. The Holy Quran, always the Holy Quran, not the Holy Bible. Examples of how people have come to Christ in the past, just inspiration from the past. So I think this is where we've got to go. We can beat them, not using their weapons. We're not going to lower ourselves to their tactics. We're not called to, you don't have a Christian terrorist network to fight a Muslim terrorist network. We have an evangelistic and prayer network to fight them. We're not going to ever lower ourselves to their tactics. No. We can't. I mean, that would be apostasy. It's against the teaching and example of Christ. But we will beat them with knowledge. History, truth. I don't think they can. They prefer the darkness. We've got to shine the light on them. Any other questions or comments?
Yes, but the Christians, I mean, we've just seen that DVD which you showed before this presentation. I mean, America, which has been such a foremost Christian nation, to actually give how many millions or billions?
Hundreds of millions of dollars. And that's just to mosques in Egypt. There's other Muslim countries getting it as well.
Yes, I mean, that is so absurd. It's such madness. I mean, it's suicide to do it.
And this is why the Muslims in Egypt are burning and bombing churches, killing Christians by the hundreds. This year, hundreds of Christians have been killed and wounded in Egypt now. How many churches have been bombed and burned in Egypt this year? How many churches are being rebuilt with American money? If they want to do something in Egypt, rebuild Christian church in Egypt. That would be that's a minority that's persecuted. That might be legitimate, although I don't know that any government's really got the right to use the taxpayers' money for anything outside their country anyway. Yeah. But that's another matter. But at least that would be a worthy cause, even if it wasn't constitutional for them to use their money in that way. But to fund mosques in a Muslim country where they've got, every time we put fuel in our tank, we're basically funding Islam anyway. Yeah. Do we need to give more? The sooner we move off gasoline, the better. Any alternative fuel would be a wonderful thing, just to defund radical Islam. Because if it wasn't for the West's dependence on gasoline, just imagine Islam wouldn't have any of the economic power that they've got at the moment. I think we're a little backwards in our technology. We should be more advanced in getting alternatives.
But I think we need to look beyond Obama, though. Yes, he has done those things. But I think the entire Western policy, the policy of Western governments towards Middle East countries, Islamic countries, which you describe as a policy of appeasement.
Yes.
For so many years now, the U.S. has been training, trying to help the PLA build a regular force that could do the functions, carry the functions of a regular army in a Palestinian state. You've had them funding similar things like that in Syria, which is now going completely haywire,
yes,
and other countries in the Middle East. And these are all countries who are turning their guns now on Israel and on the West. These are countries that fund terrorism globally. So we're looking at a problem that goes beyond, that even predates Obama. We're looking at a problem,
yes,
that involves,
oh, yes,
what the West does, thinking that it's helping to develop the Middle East, stabilize, promote democracy in the Middle East, which, at least people take your money, and they laugh back at you. And say, well, thank you for giving us this, but we are coming right for you with this money. And when you've also got policies that has really, policies rather, that have really, really promoted immigration to the West. And you go to places in Paris, in France now, and there are hundreds of these places, call them enclaves. Now, these are communities that are almost complete. They are entirely Muslim communities. And you cannot find any presence of Western government in those communities, even though they exist in Western nations.
They're no-go areas for the police.
No-go areas.
The police,
exactly,
do not even dare go there.
You can't find them there. And unfortunately, they're waking up to realize that, look, we've been sleeping all this while. And how can they take back this place that have been taken away from them? In Britain, they have laws now that recognize the practice of Sharia. It's institutionalized Sharia in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a lot of ground that's been given over to them. And how they're going to take back these grounds, I don't know. I don't know how they're going to achieve them. But I think there's a whole lot of...
Well, the first thing is, you've got to know your enemy. You've got to recognize the enemy. If you don't recognize the problem, and the way the Western nations are acting right now, you'd swear the enemy's Christianity. They're hostile to Christianity, and while they may not be comfortable with Islam, they're either afraid of Islam and appease it, or they like it just because they hate Christians. Maybe some of the Western humanists like Islam because Islam's got a frivolous view of marriage. That you can have easy marriage, easy divorce, multiple marriage, you can abuse women. Basically it's, we may not agree with everything about Islam, but it's better than Christianity. So somehow or another their view of everything, especially their view of marriage, is close to the Western view. Although the Muslims will not agree with the homosexual marriage that the same secular humans are pushing. And if they ever got into power, they'd be probably putting to death a lot of the secular humanists who are promoting them right now. So it's suicidal. But the West's got either a fear of Islam, or they've got a blindness to Islam, or they just hate Christianity so much they don't care how bad Islam is. Whatever the reason is, they are appeasing Islam, even supporting it. I wouldn't have thought that the West was so stupid as to fund the building of mosques, though. But I'm told in Europe, the European Union has taken European money and built mosques in Germany, in Belgium. Insane. Literally building mosques in these countries. And I don't know that they're doing anything to build churches, but they're certainly doing something to build mosques and madrasas. It's just insane. So Europe is acting in a suicidal way. And the reason why the Muslims were beaten at Malta and Vienna and Lepanto is because the West recognized Islam as a threat. The need to unite together and use all the energies and technology in order to defeat them. Now, at this stage, most of Europe doesn't even recognize it as a threat. So how can you win a war until you recognize that you are threatened by this enemy and that your way of life is better than their way of life? Well, actually, let's put it this way. The Bible's way of life is better than the Muslim's way of death. Can't even call it a way of life. But until there's a confidence in the alternative and a recognition of the threat of Islam, who's going to fight them? Who in the West has the attitude of Charles Martel, let's stand at Poitiers and let's stop the Muslim advance? At the moment, they've got such an attitude of, well, the only real threat to you fundamentalist Christians. And yet Christianity is the only hope of Europe, or Africa for that matter. The only force that can defeat Islam is biblical Christianity. It's done it before and it can do it again, but at the moment the West is trying secular humanism and it hasn't got a hope. Secular humanism doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell of ever beating Islam. Islam will roll right over them.